Welcome back, everyone. Hopefully everyone's enjoying our presentation so far. We had a nice little break there. We're going to dive right in now and start talking about the specifics of DirectX. Before we went to break there, we showed you a little bit of a demo on a Windows phone emulator. But today we're actually going to take some time. We're going to be working with a Windows Store application as opposed to the Windows Phone. We saw a little bit in chat there that people were talking about the phone there. Just wanted to, clarify that for you and let you know that, yes, today we're actually going to be working with the Windows Phone.
Windows Store.
Windows Store. Thanks for correcting me there. Windows Store application.
So this module, it's going to be on the capabilities of DirectX 11 and what's new to DirectX 11. We're going to cover that. Then we'll break it down into the I framework view and your app and what that class is. It's an interface that we're going to look at that runs all that stuff. And then we're going to move to the basic game loop and the update stage as well as the rendering stage. Now, we've also put the source repository up on Mickey's Scruffy Fern GitHub account. Okay, so if you go to this link here, github.com/scruffyfern/sumodx, you should be able to get all of those resources that we're going to look at. Now, that is in the completed state at the moment that we're going to arrive at the end of the day, and that's okay. We're going to be looking at discrete pieces of it as we go through these different topics and sections throughout the day. So it's all there. It should be runnable. Once you grab it all, you can mess around with it and play with it. Just pay attention as well. And I know it's addictive and fun, but hopefully we want to get to the point where you can make that and extend it and build your own. All right, so let's start off with the capabilities of DirectX 11. I know a lot of people were talking about what can we do with this and so on. It's basically a fully featured set of APIs enabling you to create high-end 2D and 3D graphics applications and games, and that's really what people most readily sort of attribute to DirectX when they hear about it. But it's actually a series of packages. There's Direct2D and Direct3D, which each handle their respective sides of those kinds of graphics. But within that, within the total DirectX API package, there's also DirectWrite, which handles all of our text rendering features and other systems like that. There's DirectX Math, which provides us a ton of handy functions for doing all the math that you love to do sitting at home while eating a biscuit or whatever. It also goes into the X input, which replaces the old direct input API that was around for quite a while. It helps you to provide console controller support, for example. And then we have the X Audio 2 package, which replaces the direct audio package and allows you to create high performance audio engines while improving performance at the same time. So it has everything you need to do all the kinds of effects that you know and love. But it is really for the person who wants to get down into the low level, optimize it so that everything can run as smoothly and as cleanly as possible. So basically, if you want to make a game that's graphics or multimedia intensive and can use the features that many of the current graphics hardware devices provide, then you're going to want to use this DirectX API. You'll likely find it a bit more complicated than other systems that you may have dealt with in the past, but that's because, again, it's opening up all of that power that you can harness to really take it anywhere that you want. Especially if you have very little C++ experience or development on the Windows platform experience, then there's going to be a little bit more of a learning curve there. But there's still some good news, and that is effectively that this version of DirectX is the most cohesive and power-packed one and feature-rich example or rollout that they've done for the API package in the past 10 years that I've worked with. So there is a lot there. There is a lot to play with. It's a great little package that can, I shouldn't say little because it's actually quite massive, but it will really allow you to do all kinds of features that you've seen nowadays in the various games that are already out there. So DirectX 11 has added support for three new shader stages in the drawing pipeline. And this is, just as the hardware develops, new functionality is added into the hardware as well as the software keeps up with it. We have things like the hull shader and the tessellator and the domain shader stages. There's the little graphics pipeline down the right. And you can see those three have really been slotted right into the middle in between the vertex and the geometry shader. The geometry shader was something that came in last time around in DirectX 10, I believe. And pixel shaders and vertex shaders have been around for quite some time. So if you've done some DirectX programming before, then you may recognize this pipeline and these three new stages do have quite new capabilities that we're not gonna necessarily harness today, but they can allow you to do a wide range of things. The hull shader, for example, it operates once per patch, and a patch is just effectively a set of vertices that make up a triangle or quad within a larger mesh typically used for rendering an object. The hull shader itself can do a couple of basic things. It can transform the input control points into output control points within a patch, but more importantly, it can provide what are known as tessellation factors, which are effectively just numbers that indicate how much a certain path should be tessellated by the next stage. Now, what do I mean by tessellation or what that is? You may have seen some demos online over the last year or so of effectively what we call infinite tessellation. You'll see a model at a low poly stage, such as there in the picture, and effectively all the vertices and the lines that make up that mesh as the camera pans in grow. More detail appears in the model, such as a face, and it just gets more and more detailed until you zoom right into the individual wrinkles. And that's effectively what we're talking about when we talk about infinite tessellation. So the tessellator is probably one of the most exciting features, really, or in terms of gamers and that is in DirectX 11. And we really want to grab that power, to harness it, and to use it in our newer games. A lot of games are starting to bring it in. It allows us to do seamless LOD. You might have, for example, in the original Halo and so on, you could open certain doorways and you'd see geometry that would look pretty blocky and then it would pop and it'd be a little bit smoother. And then after a couple more seconds, it would pop again and now it's the final model. And that was usually because a lot of the game engines are set up to load models as fast as possible, but they only have a limited time to do so. So they load in a low-level detail or a... effectively, that's what LOD means, level of detail, a lower LOD version of the terrain or a model. And then once they have enough time to get the higher res one in, they'll just pop it out with the one that's there. Eventually, we started realizing the popping doesn't look real nice. So we'll start trying to blend between the two once we have the secondary model loaded. That looked okay, but sometimes you get weird like facial deformations. Somebody's nose starts to come out of their head now that they actually have a nose. And things like that, and you could catch models at a weird angle where you see that, and that wasn't working really well. But now, with processes like this, we're going to be able to literally give an infinite level of tessellation, effectively, or geometry that we can blend seamlessly and let the graphics card sort of handle it for us without actually even having to make that high-detailed model. We can make a lower-detailed model, put on the normal bump maps and normal maps that you would see to give it some detail being a low poly model, and then the graphics card can fill it in with a shader, all that extra detail as the camera approaches. So the tessellator is the one that really generates the new geometry or the new vertices and splits each individual triangle into two triangles or more, depending on your approach, to give that detail. That's what that tessellator stage does. Then we have the domain shader, which is the third piece of the puzzle that completes the infinite tessellation kind of effect. It's invoked once per vertex generated by the tessellator, and each invocation is identified by its coordinate on a generic domain. So the role of this domain shader, that's where it gets its name, is from this conversion to a coordinate in the generic domain, is to convert that coordinate into something tangible, like a 3D point in space, for use later on in the rest of the stages of the pipeline. So that's really all it does, is convert all the math that happened, splitting up all the faces into new positions, points, and vertices. It's going to take those points of data and actually build them out into real things that exist in your game effectively. So this could have a huge impact on games with large open environments, for example. Oops, sorry. I accidentally hit my mouse. It can have a huge impact on large open environments. You've probably noticed that distance object popping. It's starting to go away in a lot of games. And really, they're finding better ways like this to switch between those LOD positions. So up until this point, we really didn't have a great solution for that, but that's something that DirectX 11 really makes available for all games and game developers to harness and pull in.
Well, it's nice, too, because it keeps that realism, right? It keeps you immersed. You don't feel like you're being, you know, pulled out of the immersion of the world, so you feel like it's an endless world, right? Like you can continue to walk off into the distance, and you don't feel like you're constantly loading or buffering the level, right? So... yeah, that's definitely a plus. It's nice to have these new shaders, that's for sure. I love the tessellation shader, you know, especially when you're doing development where your resources might be limited. You can definitely take advantage of the tessellation shader to kind of help balance that, right?
And that, yeah, that's exactly the idea, is that now you don't necessarily need three models of the same model, a low poly, a medium poly, and a high poly anymore. You don't need those. We started trying to figure out approaches that would let you create that extra art as quick as possible without actually having to have a guy rebuild it. So he makes the high poly version of the model, and then there's certain other tools that you can use to sort of crush those into a lower poly and then crush it even smaller into basically your flat, almost 2D guy, and so on. But it's all computer automated there, and it doesn't necessarily give you exactly what you need, so then you got to have a guy go back in, mm-hmm. hand touch every little vertice to make sure it looks as good as it can at that level of detail, and so on and so on. And with this now, you don't need those extra stages. You can do the one, and you do it through a 2D image, normal app or so, and then all that detail comes out and gives you that cinematic sort of quality. And actually, that's another big one. A lot of games now want to do those in-engine cinemas, right? You don't want to have to pre-render everything because you need to do localization for different voices, then your face effects will look off, and other things like that. You want to be able to really just run it in-game, no loading, seamless, just transition with this same model that the player is playing with, but now get him into that cinema doing his talking role. And this sort of helps with that because you can kick up that quality for those close-up shots with the camera trucks right in on his face or something to see, you know, the important stare down or whatever he's doing. But it'll be at a nice high quality mesh because of this dynamic sort of LOD system. So it's a neat feature. Hopefully, you know, it's going to really get in there and we'll take it in some new directions and see what else we can do. The other part of, in terms of major changes that has happened here, is there's a loosely coupled secondary pipeline. All right. And it supports, so effectively DirectX 11 now supports two separate pipelines, the draw pipeline, which we just covered, and that's your basic one that goes through and builds all the geometry, draws it out, does any color effects, and so on, and then what is known as the dispatch pipeline, or the compute shader pipeline, as it's more commonly known. These two pipelines are said to be loosely coupled because you can't have the same sub-resource bound for writing in both of the pipelines simultaneously. You are dealing with your external graphics card or graphics device, whatever it is, and it only has a limited amount of memory. You're accessing it now from two different effective systems, setting them up to do two different things, but the card itself still uses that same memory pool. So they are loosely coupled in that sense, that they share a similar place where you can write and read to. So the compute shaders themselves, they allow the GPU to be viewed as effectively a generic grid of data parallel processors without any graphics impediments from the draw pipeline. So the compute shader has explicit access to fast shared memory to facilitate communication between the groups of shader invocations. So the compute shader, it also has the ability to do scattered read and writes. If you've done any deeper DirectX stuff before, you pretty much can only go with a read. You can't necessarily just jump around and read and write as fast as you want because that interrupts the pipeline and the way the graphics card works. And setting those things, you want to try to do it as seldom as possible. The compute shader is sort of built for a little bit more of the random access, a little bit more of the data manipulation back and forth between the two systems. And the reason why we do that is effectively we're going to be using the compute shaders and that pipeline to offload any CPU heavy intensive tasks to the GPU if we're bottlenecked on the CPU. Now, a lot of people are, especially on the PC, that are going to be pulling down these Windows Store games, probably have quad cores, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So if things are written properly, you can make use of all those different threads and all those different cores. But we still get CPU bound on various other platforms and on the computer if you push it hard enough. So this is there to allow developers just to give that ability and flex. If you're not really rendering a lot right now for some reason, push some CPU-intensive operations over to the GPU, let it grind it out as blazingly fast as it can, and then pass it back for you to move forward. Examples would be AI and pathing. You can offload those. AI is typically, how do we call it, very easy to parallelize in certain senses. So we can grab all that data, put it onto the GPU in a compute shader, have it grind out our answer and bring it back to us much faster. We've got faster memory to access usually on the graphics card because you're at, you know, GDDR5 memory and so on. And we can do a lot of that load balancing, and that's really what the compute shader is sort of all about and what we're going to be, what, not today, but what you would typically want to harness it for as a developer going forward. All right, so that's enough about really what we can do with the DirectX 11, what the fancy new features are or the most exciting ones for game developers in terms of programming are. So now we're going to get into actually getting our Windows Store app up and running. Now, the starting point effectively for most DirectX App Store things is you're going to need this iFrameworkView class. And it's the main interface. That's why there's an I in front of the class name. It stands for interface, that allows us to really communicate with the underlying Windows Store system. So it controls the main event processing of the application and the main loop, and it maintains an overall state of the game. So it's going to know really what we're doing at any point in time. So the DirectX app class in the demo, if you have the source code already, you can take a peek at it. We'll sort of go through all this in the actual game in a little bit, but I'm just going to give an overview of all these different pieces right now. The DirectX app class is our class that extends that interface for us. So you can see here the reference class for DirectX app. Okay, it's going to extend our core iframe view, iframe work view. And this is really where your app code would go, whatever you want it to do, whether it's just say hi or hello world and then exit, or, you know, do some kind of crazy game logic. But unfortunately, before we can do that, we need a class that creates this view. So that brings us over here. Our DirectAppSource class, which extends the iFrameworkViewSource interface. So again, they're very closely named. So something to you know, make sure you don't accidentally hook up the wrong one to the wrong class when you're doing this initial setup. But really, all this class is going to do for us, our DirectX app source class, is it's responsible for creating that view. So there is a virtual function that we're going to overload, and hopefully most of you have you know, done enough C++ that you understand what a virtual function is. If not, we'll do a brief little overview as we go through the code, just point it out. But basically, this function is now overloaded and overwritten so that when the Windows system calls create view on this DirectX app source class, it's now going to create that other class that is really our actual application. And of course, being in C++, we can't actually do anything unless we have a main function. So here you can see the create view, it just creates that new DirectX app. But we need a main function to really fire off that part, our source part. And so we've built one here. It'll look something like this. We've specified our platform is going to be an MTA thread. That's just sort of a signifier that we need to use. You may also notice that there's these carrots being used right here. And those effectively are signifying a new type of pointer that they've built into the C++ system. It doesn't replace any of the other ones. It's just another managed pointer that is now in there. So it's customary for our C++ programs to be kicked off by a function named main. So we've added that. It returns an integer, which is just going to be zero in this case. And we have it build our app source, our class, and we tell the core application static class to run that app source, which then would cascade back. It would create our view, and from there would cascade back and actually get our main app up and running, doing whatever it is that we told it to do in the main thread. So that's really how you launch your application. Those are all the little bits and pieces that we need to really just get things up and running. And you can see that in our application. We'll take a look at it. It's pretty much bare bones. It's going to look like that in all of them. And then your actual view class is where we're going to build out all of the actual functionality for the application. But this main function can, you know, be as simple as that. And then the source view that creates the view will be as simple as that. And that's really all there is to setting up the initial pieces to get moving forward with. So, what does the DirectX app class do itself? Really, it's going to drive and it's going to maintain the state machine for our game. So it's going to create and maintain three other important references as well. They are the three objects that are used the most in the game, or really make our game exist. One is the move look controller. It's going to handle all of our input. And then we also have our SumoDX class, which is going to handle the game's logic and physics. And then we have the game renderer class, which is really just going to be doing all of the rendering for our game. Now, what states can I say that the DirectX class is going to be a state machine for our game, and it's going to have states? What does all that entail? We're going to take a look at that in a later module. But for now, it's simple states such as loading the game, whether or not we're currently playing the game, or if we're waiting for the user to press a button to continue playing the game. So earlier you might have seen that little pop-up window that came up. That's effectively the waiting for press stage, and it won't do anything until the user taps the screen or hits start on the controller or clicks the mouse on that little window to continue on. There's also the dynamic state, which is effectively going to be when we represent the game being active, people playing it, things like that are happening. And then we also need to listen for certain states that can occur from the Windows system itself. For example, what happens if the window is too small to actually represent our game and see what's going on? We can listen for that sort of signification or signifier from the Windows core and then respond to it with a state in our game. So it's going to do those kinds of things. Same with being suspended or deactivated. If you were to, for example, make a Windows phone app and you got a call, it could get suspended and so on. So all those states are going to be built into this class, and that's really what it's going to handle. It's going to move through and react to in some way. So that's pretty much all there is for the DirectX class in terms of what it's supposed to do. It also registers all of the necessary Windows Store app events to maintain just sort of the flow of how the application is running. And again, we're going to take a look at that. But right now, let's take a look at really what the basic game loop needs to be for a game. And I've written it out in pseudocode here so that we don't, you know, have to go through all of the code, because it looks a little more wordy when you put it in code. But this pseudocode is effectively breaking it down as simple as possible. This is the pseudocode specifically for our game, but it is a generic sort of basic game loop that you will see. So while the window is active, okay, if it's not active, then we probably should be doing something else. But while the window is active, we check if the window is visible. And if it is visible, if the game can't function due to size or a pop-up or it's simply paused, then we wait for a new event to change the state of the app. So that's just sort of our, you know, hold steady. We've notified the user he accidentally unplugged his keyboard or his controller or something like that, and we'd like his input. So that's just where it sort of hovers and waits. Beyond that, we can move down. If there are none of those pop-ups or anything in our way, we go into our else condition, where we do the normal processing of any incoming messages, whether it's other input or now we need to suspend the game, and so on. And after that passes through, once we've registered all those, we update the state of the game, carry out all the actual logic, the rendering, whatever it needs to be doing at this point in time. Then we get an updated rendering to the current screen. So we push that up to the actual device and flip the buffers, which we'll talk about all those things later on in another module. So that's effectively the game loop itself. It's just going to keep processing. Usually the game's active. Usually the window is visible. Otherwise, it's going to be hard to play the game. So most of the time, it's really going to spend its bulk of its time in that else condition, just doing the normal processing of the game input messages, updating the state of the world, render. Get messages, update, render. And that's really your basic game loop system. Of course, if the window isn't visible, we still need to catch any possible events that make the window visible, so we have that else case in there as well. And then finally, at the end, we exit due to the window closing or whatever other signifiers you want for closing your game, but make sure to save the game state so that they can come back and play again and pick up where they left off. Especially if you're doing a mobile device, that's very important for the mobile developers because they get interrupted with all kinds of messages and phone calls and so on. And so we want that state to be preserved for the game. So we're going to just take a quick little walkthrough of actually seeing all that now in the game itself. So I'm just going to pop out here. Bear with me as I shift these things around. Okay, so jumping up to the DirectX App H class to start, we can see that these are those engine states that I talked about, and we've just made a simple enumeration. So it's a little bit easier for you know, humans to read. The machine doesn't necessarily care if we use 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for our states, but humans tend to want to know what's going on a little bit cleaner than that. So I've written them in a plain, easy-to-read format using an enumeration. And also we have our press result state. So when we are waiting for press, if they click on the screen and we were loading the game, we're going to do something different than if we were playing or continuing. And we'll see all that again coming up. So the DirectX app itself, again, we see here, it's our main class, and it extends from the iFramework view class, which is that one that we expect to run everything in our game, more or less. So we've got all kinds of different functions on here. You can see here's our event handlers for worrying about when we get suspended, when we've been told we can resume, and so on. Those ones we're not going to spend much time on looking at right now. But there's the other ones, like such as the window being changed, the size being changed in case they scroll it. We want to respond to those events, and we'll see how we do that again later on. So if I go down here, here's our main update function that we're gonna look at right now. But just before we jump to that, here are those three main objects that this application requires to really run the game and keep everything moving. So we have our MoveLook controller, our game renderer, and the SumoDX class, which handles all the physics and the actual game logic itself. So this application now is going to create these. It's going to be responsible for really telling these three things what to do and when to do them and communicate between them all. So it's sort of the bridge or the overall class that allows us to handle those things. So I'm just going to jump over here for a second and then scroll back up. All right, so the constructor itself, the main function that we were talking about earlier, there it is in the CPP file. Again, it's just going to create a reference of this app source class. And really all that app source class does, if I jump over to it, is it really just implements that create view function. Which if we go to that, I know this is a lot of jumping, but it's just that simple. It creates our DirectX app class, which was the one we were just looking at. Here you can see we're right back below the main again. Okay, so it's just ping-ponging around, setting everything up, and then if I create that, here we are at our DirectX app. It's going to set a bunch of default flags for us for the app and let us go off on whatever our process is after that. So that's really all there is to it. These three little main function, our other source view class, and our actual app class, they all extend from those different iframe renderer classes. And that's really the basics you need to get your Windows App Store up and running. The process by which we walk through that and we manipulate that in the phone, we'll see in a bit, but that's really the code that you're looking for to get everything up and running.
So basically, it's the foundation, right?
Right.
What we need to get up and get going. It's what stores our necessary game objects for whatever implementation we might be doing.
Exactly.
So yeah, this is basically I like to refer to it as the foundation of the house.
Sure.
Right? You need to build this before you can actually start putting up walls.
And it's rock solid because it's that simple.
Yes, exactly.
There's no
right.
questions in there. You're basically going to rename things to whatever you want, but you just fill in the blanks. And then you're at that stage where we can progress forward. Now, getting something to render in your screen in DirectX so you can see what you're doing, it's going to take a little bit more work, but effectively you have that basis to actually get something to kick off through the Windows Store app process and get you in and running. Okay, so now I'm going to flip back over. Here. And we're going to be doing this process of bouncing back and forth between code and our PowerPoint quite a bit. So we've got our main game loop set up and ready to go. The application's going to kick off. It's going to get us in there. And again, those two important things that we've said it's going to be doing is effectively just going to sit in that one chunk of the loop and keep going back, updating the game, rendering the game, updating the game, rendering the game. So the update stage is really the bulk of everything that's going to happen in your application. And we've made an update function, and that's where we've put all that data. So inside that game loop, it's going to call that update function. We're going to handle initial loading and intro sequences as our game boots up. Mm-hmm. That's an important part of it. We only do that once, but it's still got to be in there, yep. right? So we do update, and those things happen. Once they're done, we can also do transitions between levels or in-game menus or other situations that interrupt sort of the flow of the game, such as pop-up messages when errors happen. So the update stage is responsible for that as well. And then it will also be responsible for updating the controller, which listens for the player's input from all of the different devices that he might be plugged into his Windows Store app effectively, and then bringing that information together, that input together, and then handing it back out to the rest of the systems for use. So most importantly, what the update stage is going to be doing is it's responsible for updating the state of that game world and all of the objects in it. That's usually what people think of when you say, oh, I'm updating my game, like in terms of the internal process, that's the part. But all these secondary things, the loading screens, the transitions between states and all that, it does that stuff as well, and it keeps that in check and sort of making sure that we're not running off into the middle of nowhere by accident. All right, so let's just take a look at the direct Windows or our DirectX apps update function and see just sort of that internal process. Oh. Oop. There we go. One extra tab more than I thought. Okay, so.
I see PowerPoint.
Oh. Sorry, I forgot to actually hit escape. There we go. Transitioning over. All righty. Okay, so I'm just going to jump to the update function. Oops. And I hit the wrong button. That's going to take way too long. Back to the header.
There's a lot of updates in there.
There are a lot of updates, yeah. Unfortunately, that's a pretty commonly used word there. All right, so here we have our DirectX update function. And right away, we signal the controller class to update and check for any user input. We're gonna spend some time looking at all of that later on, but we can just pretend, you know, you're pushing up or W or something like that to make the little sumo wrestler run around. That's the kind of stuff that the controller update function is going to be responsible for, is congregating all that data together and figuring out what the user is trying to tell the game. From there, we check our internal update state. What are we doing? Are we waiting for resources because the game is just starting and we're loading things? Or have all the resources finished loading and we now need to transition to either playing the game or continuing on from wherever they were or some other step like that, in which we just simply show an info overlay so the user knows what's going on. Please push A to do this, or show them their game stats because they just won a level, or something like that. And again, the next state we could be in is waiting for a press, which really comes from this state. Okay, there you can see we're setting ourselves into waiting for press. So now we're waiting for press. We check, has the user actually done something? And again, we talk to the controller for that. Has he pushed A or pushed start? Has he clicked the mouse button? Has he touched the screen in the right area? The controller will say yes or no every time, so we just keep sitting here checking until we see yes, and then we check again, what is the result of that? Should we now load the game, play the game, and continue on the game from there? So all of these stages, these states, there's a lot of code there. They're actually much simpler, and we're going to explore that in a whole entire module just on its own, just to see all that state information. For now, I'm just going to gloss over it and sort of still keep going with what's in these update functions. Now, this one, the dynamic state, is really the bulk, again, of our game. In comparison, you can see it's a much longer state, okay, and it's actually the last one that's in here. But really, all we're going to do in it is first check if the game is paused. So again, we talk to the controller, has he requested that it's going to be paused? And if the user has pushed it, then we pause the game, we set up some states, we wait for a press again. When they click the button, we unpause and we continue on. If they have not requested for a pause, the game continues on as normal. So we tell the game, go ahead, run the game, and just update everything in the world. So that run state is going to be returned, and we're going to check, has he lost yet, or has he won? Maybe he beat the level. Transition to some other state. If he's lost, transition to some other state, say, sorry, game over, would you like to try again, and then come back in. So this update function, effectively, in the DirectX app, it's all that higher level state controlling stuff that I was talking about. That's really what its responsibility is. It calls the functions that are actually going to do the updating of the individual game logic, the individual components, the player pieces. It also does check if things are paused, and so on and so on. So it does all of those high-level functions, just sort of keeping everything in structure, everything in order, and moves through from there as we go. The individual what happens, we'll see in those individual classes in a moment. All right, so popping back over. So a little bit of work.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's a little bit there, yes, definitely.
There is a little bit to get through that stuff. The update stage after that, the main game loop goes to the render stage, similar kind of process. It's a state in our DirectX app that's going to be an overview. It's going to do, you know, what we want it to do. It's going to render all the new positions of all the objects. But again, it's driven in a way that the DirectX apps just basically instructs, could you please do this? Could you do this? What state are we in? Fall back out, go back and do some other things. The rendering stage itself can be broken up into various parts depending on the complexity of the visuals that are required by the game. So some systems, for example, require multiple passes for advanced effects like dynamic shadows or maybe some of the X-ray visions through the walls or heat scopes techniques. Thermal vision and so on, it might have to render multiple times the same scene to get all of that detail layered in the proper way and so on. So some of the render stages in games can be quite complex and have a lot of mini stages effectively inside it. Now, luckily in our game, it's going to be pretty basic. We're going to keep to the minimum so that we can allow things to continue moving forward at a reasonably decent pace. Some systems also require that every other visit, for example, to the rendering system, alternates between two slightly different camera positions. And that would be how you'd set up things like stereoscopic gaming, if you wanted 3D.
Which is 3D, yes.
Yeah, it's 3D through whatever kind of device, whether it's, you know, something you're wearing or a 3D display or whatever. You would set it up in that manner. And every time you'd go through that render stage, you would either render it from this point of view, next time around, render it from this point of view. And oscillate between those two setups. So that's really what the render stage is all about. We're going to now talk a little bit more in depth. The steps of the basic game rendering stages is pretty much as basic as you can crush it down to. So you can think of this as pseudocode for what we want to do. Effectively, first off, you want to set up where and what it is that you're rendering to. So it could be the back buffer, it could be a texture. You've probably seen games where they've rendered a movie onto a wall while you're doing something else, or, you know, a trick for doing rearview mirrors, for example, is actually to put a camera where the mirror is and just film what's behind you and then put that on the mirror as a texture. Okay, that's rendering to a texture. Rendering to the back buffer is your typical approach. You prepare what you want to show and then you flip and actually show it once you're done drawing. If you don't use a back buffer like that, you can get that screen tearing effect you might have seen in games. Some people attribute it to a frames per second lag or something like that, but it's usually because if you don't have a double buffering system set up, you will be showing an image to the monitor before you're actually finished drawing what's in there. It can be a V-Sync issue if you're not have your game set up to actually sync vertically to your monitor. You might actually be showing half an image while the monitor is halfway done updating as well. Depending on your hardware and your software, you can get that same kind of effect happening there. So that's the back buffer that we write to. We write the whole game's image to that, and then we want to present it. So that's what we're setting up in the first part, is just what is it we are rendering to. Then we clear the screen, typically, if it's required. Sometimes it's not. Mm-hmm. You want those like flashbang effects where you sort of have that haze image of what was already there, or you want a weird shadowing behind an object as it moves. Just don't clear the back buffer. You'll have the image you had last time, and then you're just going to draw where the guy's hand is now. And so you'll get like, you know, the three or four hands in a row. Sometimes you don't want to, but typically we will want to clear the screen. So that's where we would do that. Then we go into rendering all of our 3D geometry, all our objects, the players, the enemies, and so on. Over top of that, once that's done, we render our HUDs and any 2D graphics that you want to sort of sit in front. And then finally, which I'll... I don't want to say, some developers will forget that we need certain things to always be on front, because if you don't have this here, you'll fail TCRs, technical certification requirements, or whichever way the company is that you're dealing with says it. But basically, some pop-ups are more important than others, so we actually add a little bit of a step in there for those kinds of pop-ups, so they'll always be on top of any pause menu or anything else that is a 2D graphic that you've already put up, without needing to really worry about ordering. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to draw these pop-up messages, that they're always being drawn last, so they're always on top of anything else that you're drawn effectively.
Yeah, it's something to keep like in mind when you're doing 3D and 2D at the same time, what order you're putting things
right.
on
it's
the screen.
Right, it's that same kind of thing, only now there's a third layer that you're going to want just for these kinds of warnings and pop-ups. So once we have all of those layers of all those things drawn into our back buffer or onto our texture, we present it to whatever's going to be displaying it, whether that's the screen or the geometry. So that's sort of your basic render stage step through. And in the demo, we've created a class called Game Renderer for that to handle all of that for our DirectX app via its render function. So let's just pop over and take a look at that. We'll step through that class and just see that render loop that I just talked about is actually going to be there. I just gotta grab the right class here. So if you go in under rendering folder, okay, and you jump down, we have game renderer and game renderer.h. I'm just gonna open both those up. There we go. I'll just pin them so I don't lose them for now. Okay, so there's also a bunch of comments in here in case you forget what this class is for. Okay, there's a wall of text. And actually, this is coming from another project that we're going to mention later on. There's a first-person shooter that you can see online that was also done by Microsoft. And this code, some of this code is brought from that so that this can be sort of your basic, your first step, and then you can move on and start working into that project later on. So here you can see the game render. It derives from, it's going to derive from the DirectX base class, and it's responsible for all of our DirectX, or D3D 11 and D2D objects that we're going to generate, whether they be HUDs or models or whatever. And there's a bunch of information in here. I'm not going to go through all that now. You can read it at your own leisure if you need to. But if we get down to our actual class here, there you can see it's extending from DirectX base. We have two reference classes, one to our SumoDX, which is our game class that has all of the physics and the geometry and where everything is. So we're obviously going to need to know that so that we can render these things where they are, as well as the HUD itself so that we can draw to that. And the classes and functions, the functions and methods that we have in here, basically everything you would need to do different things from setting the dots per inch on certain devices, loading levels and resources asynchronously, topics that we're not going to necessarily worry about today at all. But the framework is there, and same with the first-person shooter one. As you expand to that one, the framework is there to get more and more complicated and get more things done and spread your knowledge across all of these different features. But really, the render function, that's the one that we really want to look at and deal with right now. So I'm just going to jump over to that one. And here it is. The first step of our basic rendering loop, we said we needed to set up the rendering pass to be completed. What is it we're drawing to? So here you can see that we are setting our render target, okay? And I've already built a target view buffer effectively, and I need to get the address of that buffer to draw to. Same with a depth stencil view, and that's effectively for making sure that objects that are in front of each other draw properly in front of each other, and so on. That's really what that one's going to be for. As we go through, we're going to want to clear that depth buffer to start so we don't have any old geometry laying in there thinking that we should be drawing behind it or in front of it. We've got to make sure that we clear that out. And also, we have a direct 2D context, which we're going to set to a target bitmap. So we're actually going to render to a bitmap first for our HUD and then render it on top of our rest of our scene. So that's what I'm setting up here. So that's both the things I mentioned, one setting up to render to our back buffer and one setting up to render to something else. And that's what's in there. We need to make sure we clear our actual scene as well. Again, if you don't want to, for some reason, to do some cool effect, then you're going to put an if statement in here and say only if I'm not stunned or flashbanged or something like that.
Staring into two mirrors or something.
Yeah. Something like that. That's where you would put that. But right now we're just going to clear the whole screen to this color, which is effectively a really dark color, just as a basis to start. Not pure black, but dark. So next we check, first, are we running the game? Should we be rendering any 3D elements? Okay, that have been loaded. So we just verify that we do have a game pointer to our game class, all right? And some bit flags or Boolean flags just to check if the game is loaded and the level resources we need are loaded. That's typical. You don't want to be trying to render stuff that doesn't exist. You'll just crash and so on. So that's in there for those reasons. From there, this section really is only used after the game state has been initialized. All the device resources are needed for the game. They've been created. And associated appropriately with game objects. So things like textures have been loaded, and we know what game object needs that texture. All of that needs to be done once we get into here. So we can update variables on the graphics card in different ways. Sometimes we change things each frame. Sometimes you have to change things each vertex, mm-hmm. Okay? Which you obviously don't want to just put everything into the vertex changing buffer, and update that every vertex, because that's a huge amount of memory that you're updating thousands of times a second, or trying to. You're not going to be able to. You're going to try to, and it'll just slow everything down. So we have different buffers for different time frames. That's how we've ordered the data that we're going to give to the graphics card. It gives us, one, more control, and two, better frame rate. That's really the purpose of it. So we're logically not necessarily dividing things based on what it is I'm trying to draw. Instead, we're logically dividing things by how often you need to update those resources on your graphics device. So in this case, this is the constant buffer that changes every frame. Okay, so things that change every frame are things like the camera position. Right? We were talking about if I was doing stereoscopic vision, I need to do the right eye, then the left eye to get the two images, to get the 3D. So that's something that only changes once. We change the camera's position once per frame and then render everything in the scene. So that's something that goes into this constant buffer, for example. And you can see that actually happening here. We are setting up the constant buffer that changes every frame. We're altering or grabbing the view for that, which is effectively a 4x4 matrix that has that camera view in it for us. And that only updates once every frame. So once we've done that and we've updated those buffers, we come down here and there is a bit of a graphics pipeline that we have to deal with. Here's all those constant buffers we were talking about. Here you can see buffer that never changes. Okay, something you I've put all the buffers in here because you may have a reason for them, but to explain logically and to show you the different stages you may have. So something that you only set once per gameplay. Mm-hmm. For example, could be the resolution. It really never changes, generally speaking. Or change on resize. So these are the values that do update when the user grabs his window and does that. Maybe they want to split frame, play the game while they're, Skyping somebody or something like that.
Following through the walkthrough, right?
Sure, yeah, that's right. Yeah, sorry, yeah. Looking for where all the hidden secrets are so they can complete the game like they knew where everything was. Exactly. However you do it. So those kinds of change on resize, that's what goes in that buffer. Then we have changes every frame and changes every primitive, which I've shortened to prim effectively, so every... vertex positions and things like that, color maybe, and so on, that might change on each object. So those are those buffers that we set up, and you can see that it says VS, that's for the vertex shader. So all this information is to deal with the vertices, the geometry, and where things are. That'll go into the vertex shader, which we'll discuss and look at a little bit more in detail later on. And then we also have pixel shader buffers as well. So these are, pixel shaders are used more for doing color overlays and other effects like that, where really everything has already been rendered into position. You know where it is, and now you want to just haze it, apply a fog, tune render it, maybe put a black outline around them, and those kinds of effects. Those are sort of the pixel shader effects. We'll look at those as well. But again, you have different data that you want to update to do that, so we have different buffers for those ones. All right, so after we've got those buffers set up, the last thing we actually have to do is, walk through and render each one of those objects. So I've set up a little for loop here, and it's literally just going to go find our objects array, which we're keeping track of just things in the world in that. You can see that it has a bunch of game objects. That's the base class that I've used to represent anything in the environment. And it's just going to step through. It's going to start at the first one, and as long as we're not at the end, keep incrementing through and effectively telling that object to render using whatever its render function is. So, for example, we have a class that renders our cubes for our sumos. We have our class that renders the cylinder for the base, the mat that they're playing on. They each have their own render function so that it knows what it needs to do with its vertices to push them over to the graphics card, get everything running, and so on and so on. So we're just going through the array of elements and telling each one, please render, please render, please render, and letting them then do whatever they need to do. So that's the process of doing that 3D chunk of our render stage, effectively. After that, we wanted to do our 2D stage. Okay, so we're going to begin drawing that. And to do that, when you're dealing with the 2D context in DirectX, for the process of drawing HUDs or any 2D elements, you have to start by calling effectively this begin draw, which of course if I try to jump to it, we're in the Windows code. You can see that it's in Direct2D header and so on. And we are basically telling it that we're going to start drawing on this render target. Draw calls can only be issued between a begin and end draw call. So we know we need to start one and we need to end one whenever we're going to do 2D drawing. So I just thought I'd point that out because that's a little bit different than the 3D one. We didn't have to do that, right? There was no up here, we didn't say, I'm going to start drawing to the 3D context anywhere. Okay. But for the 2D context, you do preface it with, I'm going to start drawing now, please pay attention, and here's what I'm going to do. All right, so to handle the swap chain being pre-rotated, effectively, things aren't rotated and aligned the way we want them to. So we're going to set a default transformation that's going to rotate everything into that 2D space that we want so that it's set up properly to draw to the screen. And why we'll see, you can look through the code to see how we do that or why we do that later on. It's not that important, but basically we just want our piece of paper laying in the right spot, and now we're going to draw onto that piece of paper. So again, we only attempt to render in-game HUD and elements once everything else is loaded, once the game is running. So we check again, is there an issue? Do we have all our resources, our textures we need? If so, we have a game HUD class that we tell to render. We pass it the information about the game, so it knows, for example, how much life you have or how much ammo you have if you're doing a shooter. So basically it just has a reference to get that information. And we give it the 2D context that we want it to draw to. And then finally, the window bounds that it's going to be drawing those HUDs within. And certain platforms have window restrictions still, possibly because of CRT monitors and so on. Other systems do not, because we have standardized hardware, such as the phones. So it's nice to have those window bounds in there so that you can give it that information a little bit easier. So I'm actually going to jump to this class, and we're just going to go through the game HUD render part just to see what it does. Basically, right now, is if there's a show title flag set, we're just going to draw a bitmap. We give it its size and the width and the height, and we take into consideration any margin constraints that we need. The rectangle itself, as you can see there, takes a left and a top corner position as a float, and then the right and the bottom corner, and then it draws your rectangle of that size, and we're telling it what bitmap that we've loaded that we would like it to draw in that rectangle. So the image we want, where we want, and how big we want. And that'll just simply draw that bitmap into our context, and it's ready to go. Now, if we wanted to draw text, it's a little bit different. We can do a draw text layout. In this case, you can see that it requires an origin and then a couple of other interface setups and so on and options. So in terms of where we want it, we're gonna position it based, again, considering margins and so on and the logo size and everything, put it in there, and then draw whatever our header is with whatever brush we want and so on. So it's just some basic stuff. We'll see that, what it looks like. Again, we got to make sure the game exists. And if the game does exist, for example, during the game, we're going to tell you how long it's taking you to shove the other sumo out of the wrestling ring. So we have a little round timer that we're going to print up in the corner of the screen that's going to keep track of what's going on. So we grab the time from the game. We combine that with the string saying round time. And we get that length, and we turn it into a string, and we tell it to draw that text down here, telling it the length and, of course, the buffer containing all of that round time, whatever, however much time it is, in here. And we can get our text format from above, and we can draw it out in a rectangle wherever we position it again, top, left, right, corner, using the same kind of setup that you would normally do with a rectangle and so on. The only difference is that you're going to want to take into consideration things like the point size of the font, and again, the margins and so on, and how that's all going to fit together in that rectangle when you build it. So you can see that really you can just change this string, it won't matter, and this sort of builds itself out to be whatever size it needs to fit that, and so on. Also, if the game is actively playing, we draw a rectangle for the touch input down in the bottom left. So this is just drawing a basic a line in a square, so you can see how that's done is too. And that's just to give the user the idea of where he can touch to control the game. That's really all it's for. But we only do that during active play. We don't bother when there's a pop-up, because then they might play around with the little corner of their screen, and it doesn't need to be there. So we only draw that square in the bottom corner when they're actively playing the game. If a pop-up menu comes up, that's why that is active play flag check is there. It'll just ignore drawing that rectangle, but we'll still do all the other HUD elements. So if they pause the game, they still see the time that they're sitting at and how much time has progressed, or if they're on track to beat their high score or low score, I guess, in that case, since you're trying to get them out as fast as possible, but without the little HUD display. So just showing you different ways to do some of those features. All right, so let's step back. That has now drawn the HUD. After we draw the HUD, we need to do that overlay of warning messages, pop-ups, you know, letting them know the controller got them hooked because their brother was pulling on the cord or whatever it is. So finally, we want to draw all of those pop-ups on top of everything else. And so we check if any game info overlays are visible. And this is just a class that we're using to represent any of those pop-ups. And if it is, then we draw the bitmap that we've stored all of that information in. So remember I said we were rendering to a bitmap. That's effectively what we're going to be doing for the overlay as well. And we just say where we want to render it to. In this case, the rectangle is going to be at half your width and half your height plus the constant for how big it is. So it basically just is going to center it for us in the middle of the screen, so it's a nice pop-up, it's readily visible. The player is usually looking at the center of their screen, and now you know, just explodes in their face, and they have to deal with that message. And that's really what you want with those kinds of messages and that. So finally, as we saw earlier, we have to end our draw call to the 2D context, okay? And that just sort of wraps everything up. Now, we could get an error, and we might get an error such as the D2D error, recreate target here. That error just indicates the device is lost, and it should be handled on the next call to present so that we can deal with it. That's not a big deal. You probably won't lose your computer while you're playing on it, but you never know. but that's what that error is there for. I had it stubbed in from earlier. And finally, the last thing we have to do is actually present the finished image. We have drawn all our 3D models. We've drawn all of our 2D overlays and our HUDs on top of that. We now have a pretty picture we'd like to display to the user, and that's what that present function will do. It'll just, I shouldn't have peeked. Went to the wrong one. Sorry, go to definition, there we go. It's really just going to be calling this command, which if you've done DirectX before, that's the swap chain present. So you're now saying, please present this other image that I am now finished with, and I will begin drawing in the thing that you just took off screen effectively so you can present it next. So that's the sort of the final step in actually getting it onto the screen. And there are a couple other like gotchas that we want to pay attention to, such as is the window being stretched or squished for some reason at the moment? And if so, notify that that's happening so we re-render the screen even though we just finished doing that. But this is the important part, that finally we present it. The rest of it is just sort of for rubber bumpers to, you know, make everything nice and cuddly so nobody sees any weird situations. So that's pretty much all there is to the render stage. Just let me pop back here. Make sure I hit the right keys to get back in there. But that's really all there is. So the update stage does all the logic, the render stage handles all the drawing of everything that we've done after the logic, and that's it. Now, the update stage itself, let's just dig into the game's update stage for a second. So I'm just going to go back to the code because there is something I forgot to show as we're going through that. I actually want to show you what it is that the game is going to do inside that SumoDX class. So if you go inside SumoDX CPP here, I'll also open the header. Again, there's some comments in here so you sort of know what's going on. The important things, move look controller, game renderer, a camera, also very important, and that list of things that we are rendering, that render objects list. So that's where it comes from. So I'm just going to pop down here. You can see that there's not too many states in this class. It's pretty simple. We do have our run game. That was the one I wanted to show you for a second. And if I go to that definition, so this is the one that gets called by the update stage before we do any rendering or anything like that, after the input has been detected. And it's just going to do simple things like update the timer so that we see, again, the render, how long it's taking you to push the sumo guy out of the ring. That's controlled by that timer. So we need to make sure we update that before we render. Keeping the camera facing the direction of whatever the user's input is. Letting the player actually move velocity-wise. And we'll come back here and we'll look at this when we get to physics. This is where all of our physics is going to happen in this update dynamics function. And then after that, did he leave the mat or did the opponent leave the mat, in which case the game is complete or the player is lost and vice versa. And we may want to save his high score, for example, if he achieved one. So that's really all that update function does within the game itself. Again, it's broken down into as small chunks as possible, so everything's nice and easy and tidy to manipulate, to find what you were looking for, and to work with. Okay.
So basically what's happening is we're checking for our input, right?
Yes.
Then we're going to pass that input along to our objects. We're going to let our objects take in that input. We're going to do the physics on those objects.
Yep.
And then finally we're going to step into our rendering and render where they've been moved to and after all the physics has been done.
Exactly. That's the general update step stage that we do, and then we do the rendering stage after that. So that's your basic game loop. You don't have to write it out in classes like that, all segmented like that. But it, as your game grows and as things get bigger, that will be a big deal. It'll just help you find all the little bits and pieces that you need to pull everything together. And so that's why I've shown it that way, it's set up that way, so you sort of can see where to grow your games if you're used to writing things in one class or smaller little setups, okay? This is sort of your extrapolation into how to break it out into three major pieces, the renderer, your actual game that updates everything, and the controller for input, and then wrap it all together in one application class that steps through all those things.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we went through a lot there, that's for sure, right? And, well, you know, we looked at the foundation or the framework of the game. You know, we looked at how do you update everything, and then finally we looked at how to render everything. So that was a really good overview of the basics for building the game, right? What the things that you definitely need to do. So we're... Sounds like it would be a good time to take a break, eh? And let everybody kind of stretch their legs and, you know.
We'll dig into it a little bit more discreetly and specifically on how to render certain things and get something showing now in your game, now that you have that framework of how we're going to manipulate everything in the game itself.
Sounds good. So, yeah, we'll take a 10-minute break, and when we come back, we'll dig into, creating, texturing, and moving some objects.